Thank you, David. Can you guys hear me? Okay, great. Well, if there's one trait that all regulatory lawyers share, although I guess not all czars share this trait, it's that we like to follow the rules. So I'm going to try hard to stick to my allotted speaking time, and that means that I'm going to talk about subsidiarity, federalism, and the common good at the highest conceptual level, and we can get into practical applications in Q&A if you guys want to. So I started to care about these concepts because I had no other choice. As David mentioned, in 2019, I found myself the head of OIRA. How many of you have heard of OIRA before? Wow, that is a sign of a policy wonky audience, I have to tell you. That is about 20 times the usual response rate. Most of you know that that OIRA is the central regulatory hub, and the White House has to sign off on agency regulations before they can go out into the world. So I became head of the office unexpectedly, and I found myself desperate to discover what I needed to know to do a good job. And I found the twin notions of subsidiarity and the common good the key to the enterprise. Now, I just said the twin notions. That's a spoiler. It may have surprised a few of you, because it's easy to think of subsidiarity and the common good as in tension, maybe even in contradiction. Subsidiarity seems a doctrine of decentralization. It's a doctrine that upholds smaller groups against the central authority. The common good, on the other hand, seems a doctrine of centralization, sacrificing the independence of smaller groups to overarching social goals. What I'd like to do in this talk is explain why this tempting way of relating subsidiarity to the common good is wrong. Subsidiarity and the common good do not oppose, rather they support each other in many ways. I'm going to focus on just one of those ways. I'd like to show that the widely dispersed decision-making that subsidiarity protects is itself part of the common good. That is to say, subsidiary in action constitutes the common good in part. There's been much written in recent years on the concept of a common good, but the idea is actually quite intuitive and pretty familiar from daily experience. It's not hard to pick out, for instance, the common good of a family. A house, a car, utilities, etc., are all good because they're all useful for things the family reasonably wants to do. And we can say they're common because they redound to the benefit of all the members, not just the mother or the father or the particular children. They're part of the family's common good. What about the good in the refrigerator? Well, the food in the refrigerator, which is a good. In a technical sense, it's not common because each piece of broccoli or leftover pizza has to end up in one particular stomach. But the distinction isn't really relevant for our purposes, so I won't dwell on it. We can treat things like shared food stocks, the water in the tap, etc., as all common goods. I've mentioned just the family's possessions, but there are other kinds of goods that qualify as common goods. We could think of shared good habits, an effective routine that lets the family accomplish its daily round rather than devolving into chaos, at least on most days. So all these things, and we can name others, are instrumental common goods. They're good because they help the family do other things that are worth achieving, but they're not worth having for themselves. A piece of pizza that stays in the refrigerator for all of time turns out not to have been a good at all. But there are other common goods which are not instrumental, but final. We know from Aristotle that final goods, things worthy in themselves, must be the end of any series of choices if those choices are to have point and purpose, if they are to constitute true human choices at all. And at least some final goods are also common goods. So a family I know in Hillsdale, I went to Hillsdale for undergrad, likes to make music together. And their family concerts are final goods, right? A right-thinking family doesn't make music just for money or for any other necessary thing, although they might seek those goods as well through performing. But they also do it because it's a beautiful thing to make music together with those we love. A family concert is common because each family member shares in the good. A child in a bad mood can't storm off to his or her room carrying his piece of the concert with him. If they're going to have the good, you're going to have it together. Now, what about family meals? On the one hand, it's tempting to think of these as instrumental goods. We just talked about food as a paradigmatic instrumental good. You have to have food to stay alive. But in good family meals, the members also do things worth doing for their own sake. They say grace. They talk and laugh together. They bear themselves with courtesy and generosity toward each other. They serve each other's needs. The meal, though undoubtedly an instrumental good, may also become an occasion for common final goods. We see this pattern all over the place throughout family life. The instruments of life provide occasions for ways of living that are valuable in themselves. To put it in technical terms, we might say that finality supervenes on instrumentality. Now, if we turn from family to political life, we see the same two basic kinds of common goods. Very many political common goods are instrumental. The roads we share, a thriving economy, just laws justly enforced, public safety and peace. But some political goods are final. For instance, think about the concert of resolution, ingenuity, and unimaginable courage that Churchill called Britain's finest hour. No doubt, the British and broader Allied war effort was instrumental. The soldiers, statesmen, and women, and men and women at home fought for the sake of freedom and a just and honorable peace. They surely didn't fight the war for war's own sake. But at the same time, the extraordinary way in which they fought was worthy in itself, which is why, of course, we hold them out for such deep admiration. We can get a clearer picture of the final good realized in a sublime way in the Allied war effort and in much less glorious but still real ways in everyday politics if we turn to the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas. I mean, we're in a discussion on subsidiarity, after all, so you had to see that coming. In the Summa, St. Thomas takes up the question of God's providence. He observes that God acts through agents. In Thomas's words, I'm going to read now, he governs inferior things by superior. So on Thomas's account, God doesn't just bring forth the food that everyone needs on his own. He lets farmers play a role in bringing forth food. Now, a human leader often governs through agents because he can't be everywhere at once. But God can and is everywhere at once, yet he too governs through agents. And so Thomas asks why that is. And he says it is, quote, that's a dramatic pause. Thomas says it is, hello? There we go. Quote, not on account of any defect in God's power that he governs through agents, but, quote, by reason of the abundance of his goodness, so that the dignity of causation is imparted even to creatures, end quote. Or, as Thomas puts it in the Disputed Questions on Truth, quote, the first cause out of the immanence of his goodness not only makes things to be, but also to be causes, end quote. There's a kind of dignity or worth to being a cause, and such is God's love for creatures that he shares even this, his own role as providential cause with us. Now, we can easily verify the dignity of causation from our own experience. It's perfectly clear that we're better off bringing about the good by our own initiative and wisdom than merely receiving it. Better off as agents whose actions bear good fruit in our own lives and those of everyone around us than as the futile putty of circumstances and other people. After all, we start our own businesses, design our own homes, tend our own gardens, write our own poems and love letters, make our own household repairs, and raise our own children. Each of these things could be left partly or wholly to others, and doing them often involves considerable effort and risk. Yet we do them, and other things like them, believing we would otherwise miss out on much of life's meaning. One place this good of moral causation and moral agency is available is in politics. Working for the good of our community, the common good is itself a good. We're better off contributing what we have of wisdom and initiative to the well-being of our communities than merely being carried along by the wisdom and effort of others. This is why we rightly admire people like Churchill or Lincoln or Thomas More or Cicero, etc., who contributed magnificently to the good of their communities. Their work of causing peace, safety, and justice is a noble thing. Being at work in this noble way is itself profoundly worth desiring, worth achieving. Now, to be sure, politics is not an end in itself. Sensible men and women engage in politics for the sake of the good things like peace and plenty that politics yields. But the very good for these, but the very need for these good things creates an additional opportunity for good, the good of causing the good things themselves. And reasonable men and women wish for the chance to engage in politics, as in others of life's pursuits, so they can become causes of goodness. Of course, there are plenty of other reasons to wish to engage in politics, such as the prevention of tyranny. But even if, as is not true, we could find a perfectly wise and virtuous despot to reign benignly over us, we would have good reasons to reject his services, for such a reign would deprive us of the chance to cause the political common good for ourselves. Under his reign, we would cease to be moral agents in the life of our communities. Now, a citizen does not contribute to the common good in isolation. Each citizen's efforts find their home in a web of efforts by others. The soldier at the front in World War II, the statesman in Washington or Whitehall, the mother attending a victory garden, all these were part of a symphony of heroism played by all citizens of goodwill, a concert extending back in time to the creators and transmitters of the moral heritage that made those who fought the war the kind of people they were. This common being and work of the people, bringing about the good of their community across time, is itself a great good. It is a great part, in fact, of the political common good. And so is any contribution, however modest, to the welfare of our communities. Of course, automatons do not cause the common good or anything else in a morally rich sense, any more than a paintbrush causes a painting. To become a part author of the common good requires us to act under the guidance of our own love for the good, rather than as a mere instrument under the compulsion of others. And the more we add of our own ingenuity and initiative, the more we are co-authors of the common good. So the dignity of causation demands a degree of freedom. Subsidiarity exists precisely to protect this freedom, to be a moral agent in one's own life and the life of one's communities. The term subsidiarity was coined in the papal encyclical Quadragesimo Anno, though the concept's roots go back much further, back at least to Aristotle. The basic idea is that the state or any other central authority should do only those things that persons and smaller groups can't do for themselves. Some people, when they hear the word subsidiarity, think of corporate subsidiaries. They worry that subsidiarity treats persons and smaller groups as basically branch offices of the state. But in fact, subsidiarity is derived from the Latin subsidium, meaning a military reserve. In the Roman army, the subsidium came into action only if the frontline troops failed to rout the enemy. So subsidiarity's vision is that persons and smaller groups are the front line for engaging society's problems. The central authority comes into play only when persons and groups are not up to the challenge. Subsidiarity refuses to reduce people and their groups to cogs in a machine run by the state. Rather, it views them as moral agents with their own capacity and responsibility to make decisions for themselves and those entrusted to their care, with the state stepping in only when things go seriously awry. One device for giving effect to subsidiarity is federalism. In fact, James Madison gave a very subsidiary explanation of the division between federal and state authorities. He said, the federal government, quote, is limited to certain enumerated objects which concern all the members of the republic, but which are not to be attained by the separate provisions of any. But federalism and subsidiarity are not the same. In fact, subsidiarity is at least as much concerned with marking off decisions from all government control as with allocating decisions to smaller political units. It favors not just local political decisions, but a robust civil society. When we follow the counsel of subsidiarity, we leave space wherever possible for people and families, neighborhoods and businesses, churches and synagogues and schools to contribute out of their own initiative and practical wisdom to meet the needs of others. In fact, we leave them, in the words of Pope Benedict XVI, opportunities to love. We can now see how the local dispersed decision-making, which subsidiarity protects, relates to the common good. As we saw above, the moral agency of the people, bringing about their community's common good, is itself something worthwhile. It is also something the people share. This is why, while it is indispensable for achieving the common good, it's also part of the common good. We are better off pursuing the common good alongside all our friends, our neighbors, and fellow citizens we don't know, than having it sorted out for us by someone else. Of course, from the state's perspective, subsidiarity's open space is full of risk. People and groups may not adopt the solutions the state would prefer, or they may botch implementation of the solutions they do choose. And we should in candor acknowledge the force of the objection. People, whether acting alone or in small groups, sometimes fail to achieve the peace, plenty, and other political goods the central authority would have achieved. But the point of these instrumental political goods is to enable the citizens to thrive. And one way they do that is by exercising moral agency. It would be foolish to sacrifice human thriving itself for the sake of more surely obtaining the means of human thriving. We may, if we like, imagine an omnicompetent despot who meets his people's every need. But doing so, he would treat them as sheep under a shepherd's care, rather than protagonists in their own lives and the life of their community, a protagonism that is one of the great goals at which any sound politics aims. When we follow the guidance of subsidiarity, we do not just adopt measures that are likely to lead to the common good, we engage in and invite others to engage in a symphony of prudence and justice and even charity that is itself one of the noblest realizations of the common good. And with that, Alex, over to you.